Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Gwynne Hunt. I'm from Tripwire. Tripwire is a company based in Portland. We do enterprise solutions for security, namely things like file integrity monitoring, database integrity, vulnerability assessments, dynamic threat analysis. We don't do antivirus, that kind of thing. That's not our job. We've been around about 16 years and about 500 people. So who am I? Well, I've been cranking software for quite a bit of time, C++ since 1994. Currently, the last 4 years I've been with Tripwire as a tech lead for new solutions for new generation security applications. Previously, I was with iMove, a perpetual startup. Have you ever been in that world? It's a lot of fun. You don't get paid that much. Sometimes you don't get paid at all, but you do cool things like in one day, reverse engineer a FireWire driver and then terminate fiber in the afternoon. But anyway, I did that for 10 years. And then IBM, C++, and Java, and I will admit it, I coded COBOL a long time ago with EDS. But I saw the light, I read my first KNR book, and I've been in that direction since. So why do we care about security? Almost every day we hear about another data breach. And these are some of the big ones recently in North America. Target, Home Depot, JP Morgan, Apple, Google, White House, and OPM. Now, I started two of these because I'm directly affected by these two breaches that I know of. There's maybe another one. Home Depot bought some paint supplies quite some time ago. And when I was back east last February, because skiing here was horrible, I was in Vermont, someone was using an exact replica of my card, which I had in my pocket, in Brooklyn, checking parking meters and making charges. And according to my bank, they suspect that it came from the Home Depot data breach. The last one, if you've ever filled out an SF-86, that's just for a security clearance with the federal government. Since 2000, it's all electronic, and there was over 21 million records that were leaked. We think a nation state to be named did this. And so things like they just also released yesterday that over 5 million people had their fingerprints. So somebody somewhere has got my fingerprints and got my whole history, everything about my brothers and sisters, my mom and dad, cats, dogs, everything I knew. So anyway. Some statistics. These are overlapping categories, but from the Online Trust Alliance, 89% of all these data breaches were considered preventable. They can identify a single event or a single couple of events that if they were properly taken care of, the breach probably wouldn't have happened. 31% are due to inside threats. That doesn't mean disgruntled employees. It could be an employee leaves a cell phone that has the LastPass master password in it and has all the corporate passwords at a bar somewhere. So it's, you know, dumb things like that. Weak or stolen credentials, social engineering, just little things like, oh, I forgot my elevator pass. Can I ride up with you? And somebody gets on and sees an open terminal, gathers enough information that's used for another attack down the road and eventually ends up becoming a data breach. 37% in 2014 were analyzed to be direct attacks. People were going specifically for a particular bank or a particular government facility. And then lost or stolen devices. 2013, a couple other of these organizations said 823 million personal records were exposed. You can imagine what it was in the last couple of years. Okay, gotta be smarter than the clicker. Okay, types of threats, obviously crime, organized crime. There are big syndicates, especially in Eastern Europe, that like to steal money from us, steal money from everybody, state-sponsored, insiders, script kiddies, people, they read about a script on the internet, and they get on, and they run a war script trying to get into any particular box they can find. Breaches often start small. weak or stolen credentials or lost or stolen devices can start a cascade of events. Small compromises eventually leading to the data breach, but sometimes they happen really quick. The Target breach, according to Krebs on Security in September 2015, once in the network, attackers had full access to all store POSs and the whole, all of Target. No partitioning whatsoever in their network. The initial breach was compromised VPN credentials for an HVAC firm. Interesting point too, the black POS malware that was found on all the car readers in Target, an updated version was found in Home Depot, and it was altered a little bit to made to look like a part of the antivirus package that was on the Home Depot systems. So what are we going to talk about? Well, we're not going to try to solve the big macro problem. We're going to focus a little bit on what developers can directly access, and specifically in our world, in the C++ world. And I'm going to go through a little bit about, talk about some references that are out there, some books and a website, talk about some integer vulnerabilities. I'm not going to get into strings or arrays. We just don't have the time for that, but there are great sources for that. Talk a little bit about a programmer's toolbox, some processes, and then I'm going to go into a detailed scenario of applying some security rules. Okay, three books that I highly recommend. This first one, Secure Coding, yeah, it's a little bit old, but what I really like about this, it doesn't try to be a cookbook, like you see this, follow this solution. What it does, it sets up kind of the total holistic view of how to approach security. That security is not something you just bolt on to an application, throw a couple of flags in release mode, and it passes that and send it out the door. No, you need to start from the very beginning, what the application is supposed to do, and figure out what things you could do to protect it. I like this book a lot. This book, I saw it's for sale outside. Highly recommend it. Both in print and also in Kindle form. It's actually very readable on Kindle. This is the second revised book from Robert Secord. If you want the nitty-gritty detail about stack smashing and canaries and all that good stuff, go to this book. There's page after page of really good information. And this last one, it's also a little bit older, but I liked it because John Vega talks a lot about interfacing, OpenSSL. It's an earlier version, but talking to all the different APIs. So if you ever have to deal with OpenSSL, this is one of the good places to start from. And then this website, this is put on by CERT. Robert Secord is heavily involved with it. And we'll take a quick gander of what that site looks like. This is the SEI CERT coding standards. There's a bunch for Android, C, C++, and Java. First, I want to take a look at, let's take a look at C++. And look at this introduction first, talk about priority and levels. Every vulnerability or issue here is classified using this standard. Of vulnerability, likelihood, and the remediation cost. So when we get a little farther into here, we'll take an example of C++. Declarations initialization, we'll start right from the beginning. Goes in excruciating detail, basically, don't use the old C stuff. Here's the C variable variadic interface. And it talks about the rationale, why this is non-compliant, and then offers compliant solutions. So every category it's here that they list on the site follows the same pattern. Some are a little stale, but most of them that I've seen are real current. A lot of folks are spending some really good time in this. Okay. So I'm going to start with integers. And homework for you all, take a look at the strings and arrays, and particularly in the C chord book. Let's take a look at integers. Unsigned integer wrap, signed integer overflow, and conversion issues. Okay, so we're going to look at some code. Okay, this is a real simple program. I'm taking a unsigned 32-bit int. I'm setting it to max value for 32-bit int, incrementing it, and then I'm setting it to the min value and decrement it. And we'll take a look at what it does. So it's as we expect. It's good to be reminded that we're at the top end of a 32-bit int. We increment it. We're going to wrap to zero. Okay, and no surprises there. What about integer overflow? Signed int overflow. So this is similar, but this is with signed ints. And we're going to go to the max value. We're going to increment, and then go to the min value and decrement. No surprises here, right? We're at the high end of the 32, but we're going to wrap all the way to the negative value. Let's take a look at conversions issues. I've got a couple conversions here. I've got a 32-bit int, and I've got unsigned ints. I'm assigning the value of 32-bit at max value to a signed 32-bit int. We expect some loss of data there. Then I'm going from an unsigned 32-bit int to a unsigned 16-bit int. Let's go see what that looks like. Okay, so you can imagine that if you're not doing any kind of range checking and you're doing converting back and forth from signed to unsigned, you can easily get into problems. And I'm gonna have a simple application I'm just gonna call bad application. And this guy's purpose is got a little worker class, and in it, it's got a work thread. And this guy, all it does is consume a large buffer and sleeps, but you can equate this to a worker thread. And then based on argument input, we're using program options. We set the thread count, and we're off and running. The default is 3 on this, so I'm running at 3 threads. I'm going to switch to a VM because I don't want to crash my Mac. Sorry. Okay, I'm going to run this with 400 threads. Take a look at this screen right here, this memory utilization. Whoa, I've basically DOS'd my box. It's because I've got unbounded, I'm not checking at all on the inputs. And why did I bring out this scenario? This is actually a fairly common scenario. You can imagine that you've got a package of applications. Maybe you got a little daemon that sits on a UDP socket, does some utility, but nobody's really touched it in 5 years, but it's always distributed with the new software. Somebody gets on a new box, systems administrator touches the file system, all of a sudden it's world readable. Somebody gets on the box, they're at least they have an account, they're looking for ways to compromise it. And so they're going to look for, let's go to opt, and see if we could find an application. Copy it over into a temp directory, play with the command interface and see what they get. And they got gold here, they can shut the box down whenever they want, all in user space without having root access. So a way to mitigate this a little bit, I've got a better app. This is pretty complex, I surgically removed a bunch of code from stuff I wrote 4 years ago with the equivalent of using a weed whacker. But what this does is give strong type safety to arguments. And so I have this properties class that I add a 32-bit int property. I give it this is what the actual argument is online, a default value and a description, and I set a range on it. So right off the bat, I'm setting the maximum between 1 and 3. And so when I try to run this application, and I'll run this on a Mac every day of the week. Okay, default to 3, then let's say and we get an exception right off the bat. So the behavior of this, it just throws an exception. We typically, what we do is log that there is an out of range, and then we use a default because our systems have to come up. But this is also a decent behavior. Maybe that you just log it and exit. And if we go the other way, we go to 0, we get the same thing, we're out of range. It didn't take a lot to add this capability. And we'll take one more look at the code for it. It's all based on a bunch of templates, but they have this thing called a basic property. The basic property has a name, description, default value, a value, and a string value. And it has some setters and some getters, and the ability to set range. And then subclass that, and I have a numeric property here, a template for that. And you can imagine you can do one for strings, you could do one for boost file paths, you could do it for time durations. There's all kinds of different properties, but you can follow the same pattern. Okay. I want to show you one more thing. Robert Ramey, if you folks have met him, he has introduced a library into the Boost Incubator called Safe Numerics. And I like it a lot. I haven't used it much, but I think it's got some good application. And here's, if you just Google Boost Library Incubator, then look for Safe Numerics, you'll find this. And the problem is that often, as I showed earlier, mathematical operations don't do what you think they're going to do. And he builds a case for it. And then his mechanism is a set of header-only templates that introduce this idea of a safe integer, for example. And if you try to set this integer outside or use a different value outside the range, an exception gets thrown immediately. People ask, what does this have to do with business and that sort of thing? I would say that almost any system you can think of value, flight control systems, ABS brake control systems in a car, anything to do with money, the ranges, they're very important. And so you'd want range checking, and this kind of facility could be very helpful. Robert Secord, in his book, gives a couple of nice tables of all the different conditions and operators that can cause wrapping of an unsigned integer. And like I said, there are a lot of these operators. Maybe you don't think it's going to happen, but there's a good chance it will. And then with signed integer overflow. And he also has a similar chart for truncation. So when you go buy the book outside there, you can thumb through these. Excuse me. Conversions, generally always safe to go from small unsigned ints to large unsigned ints, but potentially not safe, and the programmer has to step in for these other cases, particularly when truncation is a possibility. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about Programmer's Toolbox. First thing I like using is multiple compilers. This is the set of compilers I use, because compilers, even different versions of the same compiler, give you different warnings and errors. So I routinely always code on GCC 4.8 and Clang Xcode first, and then go to the others. I have a lot of code that runs on Windows XP embedded, so I'm still stuck to Visual Studio 2010, but I will be moving to 2015 as soon as I can get that running, because it has a tool chain that allows cross-compile to XP targets. But a lot of value in, like, if you're not quite sure in one compiler, run it, bring it up in another compiler. Intel compilers are also very good. They're not as compliant with C++ 11 or 14 as the others, but they get in there quickly. The thing about the Intuit tools, they've got a wonderful profiler called VTune Amplifier, if you haven't used it. I think it's one of the most user-friendly out there. Other things, put this in your toolbox. These are a list of flags that will get you discover warnings and problems that you won't get when you just run it in debug, maybe debug mode. All of these are GCC and Clang, except for the sanitize, that's Clang only. On Xcode, it only supports address. Thank you. I'll make that change. It's good to know. Okay, this is probably very stale, but on Visual Studio 2010, these are the additional flags. I'm sure 2015 has some other ones. I'll update that when I'm able to bring up Visual Studio 2015. Other flags that help mitigate attacks. These do things like prevent or help reduce buffer overflows on the stack, eliminate execution capability. Not all of these are visible in Clang or usable in Clang, and I identified those in blue that are GCC only. Also, memory relocation or ASLR in the Windows world, PIE in the kind of GCC world, all very useful. And before I get back to code, I want to just breeze through some of this secure programming processes. This first one may seem like, oh, this is just another architect filling up slides, but I think it's pretty important. As an organization that wants to build up a capability, a secure capability, you need to kind of define the framework that you work within. And we use principles and mechanisms. And one principle may be all internet domain sockets connections have to be encrypted. And the mechanism we use, TLS 1.2, high string cipher suites, X509 PKIX compliant with RFC 6125 for identity verification. I'll get into more detail what that means. Principle, we authenticate the message source. And a mechanism is we use hash-based message authentication codes across the whole message. And so we can tell if they're tampered and we know who signed it. Principle, all applications must build with no warnings. Now, there are going to be cases where you're going to have to locally suppress a particular item. But generally, like one of our principles is that no warnings. Force common coding standards. I know it's going to harsh someone's mellow, but people that like to code any way they want. But the best pattern matcher on the planet is probably the human. And the ability to see common recognized shapes and patterns will pick up errors so quick and pick up problems so quickly. But it also makes the code more readable. When you see somebody else, some other colleague, you haven't worked with them, and our code looks the same or is formatted the same, it helps a lot in understanding. There are a lot of good examples. People point to Google's C++ coding standards. We use a lot of it. We don't use the portion of it because our code is a lot newer. We use exceptions all through our code base, so we deviate from that. Plus, my company's mostly historically been a Java shop, and so we camel case everything, so we don't use underscores in our names. Code review system, we use review board. That's one example. I like it better than pull request. It has to get a thumbs up by people on the team before we commit. Version control system, it's probably real simple, but if you don't have, if you're not using one, your code isn't that important. You really need this for a team of developers, especially distributed. We used Bazaar for a long time and it was good, but no one's doing anything with Bazaar, so we all went to Git and we got to GitHub. And for the most part it works good, but Git can be really frustrating at times. Then the last thing, a defect tracking system, particularly when it's integrated with the version control and your code review system. It makes everything seamless. There's no, you don't lose information, and everybody has context to a particular problem. And the automated continuous integration, these are things that we do every night. I've got 30 some odd platforms. My main code runs, static analysis runs, automated fuzzing, daily integration tests on all target platforms. And it's a big deal if something breaks. And we've got to investigate all failures, and that includes testing failures, because they may mask some other failure. So we treat a test problem just as important as an application problem. Okay, penetration testing. If you're large enough, grow some ethical hackers, some people that can break your code. I wish I could say who are third party, but we use a lot of third party. And I specifically will go in with the full code and I'll say, break this, I want you to break this point, I want you to bring that point. And they've been very helpful in helping us harden our code. Very, very expensive, but very worthwhile. Okay, now we're gonna get back into some more code, and I got a scenario here. Imagine a company that does, it's called Consolidated Services, that provides web backend and web processing engines for a bunch of virtual stores. These stores are all visible from the internet. You got a bunch of customers worldwide, and then you got fulfillment houses that when a product gets ordered, one of the processing engines sends a fulfillment order to the appropriate fulfillment house. So we're focusing on the yellow here in this connection. And as Consolidated Services, we want our partners to do it right. We don't want them to lose information about customers. We don't want any issues. So we're going to help them by building a library. And this library is going to do some message handling, parsing, and serialization. And it's going to do encryption and decryption. The security considerations that we're going to protect the session with TLS 1.2. We're going to authenticate the message source, and we're going to encrypt the fulfillment order. So this is security in depth and in layers. First, TLS 1.2, if you're not using it, you're vulnerable. If you're using 1.1, you're wrong. Using 1.0, you're wrong. SSL 3, go dig ditches or something. You're in the wrong job. High-strength ciphers. This is an example, the elliptical curve, ephemeral Diffie-Hellman, and I broke down what the different pieces mean of the algorithm, but this is a relatively efficient but very strong cipher suite. 6125, I put this here because there's a lot of confusion and there isn't a lot of information that's easily digestible. But 6125, basically, you're using items that you strategically place in a subject alternate name of your certificate chain that help you verify that you're not communicating with somebody that's acting as a man in the middle in an attack. And part of that mechanism is to use service IDs, that FO server that is represents a service, message represents a protocol, and then the rest of it is a domain. And then you got the same for the client side. also additional fields that are set in, if you're a server, you never want client offset. You never want it to be set for key CRL signing. You don't want those kind of things. It just needs these settings for a server, and a client needs to be for a client. And if you get someone that says a server off, you should reject the conversation. And the reason I put this here is because I don't know of a fully compliant 6125. I had to write a lot of code to do this. I use Boost ASIO, and I use exits out of OpenSSL callbacks to, once OpenSSL does the certificate path verification, then I iterate through all the certificates and look at these specific fields and match them up that they're compliant. Okay, almost the code again. The second thing we're doing is we're using a message that we're using the HMAC code in front of it. And HMAC, or this is the message format, it's a serialized protobuf message. It has an HMAC field, it has a UID field identifying a unique message, a type, time, and then encrypted message bytes. That HMAC field is across all other fields. So you can tell if anybody tampers with any component of the message. So with that stuff done in advance, we've got kind of an idea of what a structure might be, and this is a candidate structure. We're building a library. The L0 at the bottom, that's third-party stuff. We're using OpenSSL, and logically, we're using a bunch of stuff from Google Protobuf. Even though it ends up in the bindings, I just put that down there that's saying we are using stuff from Google. Then I got a low-level layer, which we'll walk through some of these pieces that are OpenSSL, but they're not meant to be the public interface we want the third party to use. And then we have L2, which is the actual public interface we want the third party to use. So they don't have to get mixed up in the, how am I doing for time? Half hour? Good. We don't want them to get lost in the nitty and gritty of OpenSSL. Okay, last thing before we get to code, I'll talk a little bit about the AES, it's pronounced Ganwal counter method. Ganwal, or G-A-L-I-O-S, they're a mysterious company in Portland, about 50 people, supposed to be really smart. They have large foreheads. They do a lot of work for DARPA and that sort of thing, but they came up with this years ago. You have certain inputs. You have a 256-bit symmetric key derived from a high-quality key derivation function. The key is never sent with the encrypted message. So this is a shared secret, symmetric key. One is on the, your fulfillment house has it, and then Consolidated has the other. There could be mechanisms to rotate these keys, age them, and replace them, but I'm not going to get into that. The idea is the key is never sent with the message. Initialization vector, this is important because the very first block that gets encrypted needs some reference or a random material to do that encryption. Usually it's about 128 bits, but this particular algorithm, it's 96 bits. And then you got your plain text. In our case, a plain text is a serialized fulfillment order. Then encryption outputs ciphertext, and then 128-bit tag generated for tamper detection. And then we concatenate the tag plus the IV plus the ciphertext, and that's what gets put in the message block. Very important thing, we don't care if anybody sees what the IV is, we just never ever use it more than once for that particular key. And then the outputs, the decryption inputs, we got the same symmetric key, we got the IV, we got the tag, the ciphertext, and we get the plain text output. Okay, so let's look at code. So I go to Stack Overflow and I read and I have a cold brew coffee, and in just a few minutes I crank out No, I don't want to do my test. I crank out my very first wrapper around it. I've got, this is an encrypt algorithm. It's still pretty C-like. And it's got a decrypt algorithm. I'm hinting at a lot of things that are wrong. We'll go through that in a minute. But let's run a unit test. So it's going to compile the unit test, which is it's a boost test here. So pieces go with it. And what we've done is we've taken a key that I generated through a random sequence generator function that's based on OpenSSL. I created the IV, and then I've got a plain text, which I just generated a bunch of sequences and concatenated together. Then encrypt it, and then go through the decryption. I match the original to the decrypted, and everything's happy. So I'm done, right? I got a working algorithm. Anybody hazard a guess right off the bat? Some of the things that are wrong here. Pardon me? Yes. Yes. Yeah. The comment was that the decrypt exits without cleanup, and that's very important. Which points out at this particular algorithm, I'm actually doing a dynamic allocation of the context used for Cypher. This is a deprecated interface, but OpenSSL being the way it is, a lot of the old interfaces are still visible. They're fixing in that now, especially with version 1.1. In the future versions, they're letting the stuff die, or they're making it disappear. But this is a deprecated interface. Also, almost all these functions have a return code. And with this particular C interface, you need to check the return code. And I did give a couple examples here, but where I'm returning the value, I'm not being slick. I'm being like an old C programmer. I'm returning negative numbers. I'm leaking because I'm not cleaning up on this context. Okay, so even though I got a good algorithm, if for some reason my tag value is wrong or something, I'm gonna lose memory. So I make another pass at it, still a little C-ish. I'm checking return codes, but I also got the leak problem. Okay, so this really didn't help much. Let's go to a better code. Okay, I changed from the char stars and length fields to standard vectors with unsigned chars. They work really well with this interface. I also used the new context. I have appropriate exceptions that are thrown. In the same way with the decrypt. And so let's take a look at, we'll make sure our algorithm is still there, is still correct. Okay, no errors detected. I'm using a much larger plain text field of 38K, but basically this test is very similar to the previous one. I am going to, now, since I'm pretty close, I think I've got it where I want to, I'm going to turn on the big heavy flags. Oops. In my CMake setup, I've got this debug secure target, and you notice that all my CMake, my main C++ flags, I've now turned on all the ones that would help me find issues. So when I compile this guy again, which I'm going to do just the application, just the algorithm, 44 errors, warnings, which I didn't get before. So I was like going from debug, turn on these flags, and going through these, the first time I did this kind of made my heart sink, because a lot of them have to do with boost format. And boost format works really well. I don't think it's unless you set type. Sometimes I have to create temporaries. You're going to get these constant conversion warnings. It's more important for me to use the flags than it is to use boost format. Okay, so I got to fix that. So let's look at level 4, next version. I'll roll back up there in a second. But so I replaced boost format with just a couple of helper functions, standard stream. No big surprises there. But I did introduce something here because I wasn't sure I was going to get cleaned up correctly. And so I created an RAII wrapper around the context. In this context, I'm calling save context. In a constructor, I'm initing it. And for just so we could see it, that it's actually being called context, I've got little text messages here. And then I'm doing cleanup. This is one of the rare OpenSSL functions to where a cleanup routine has a return code. A lot of them don't. If this doesn't clean up, that means something really bad. And that application's got to die. And so in this, my simple log program, I pass it a fatal, and the application should just go away. So the way that works is I create the safe context C. And so where I use the reference or the address operator on the context, it's just a little bit different with C dot, whatever. But I don't have to worry about doing a cleanup in the end because I know when the safe context goes out of scope, it's going to get cleaned up for me. I also introduced something. Those I pushed up into a null namespace, and the actual functions that the third party will use are in a public namespace. Do some size checking, because and we want to know right off the bat if the key is incorrect, or if the IV is incorrect, or if the plain text is zero. I mean, there's no reason to encrypt. So I added some additional checks for that. So with the high level flags on, compiled, and it compiles clean. Well, that's the end of my code demo. That's the end. Are there any questions? Sorry for being so abrupt. Yes. And I got a lot of boost there. Yeah, because some of this is harvested from a block of C++03. The question was, why am I using some instead of asserts?
Yeah.
That's our pattern. That's our preferred usage. Because there are very few exceptions we can't handle and recover from, is our approach. Any other questions?
So, first of all, thanks for mentioning the sanitizers.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned the third the side of everything about security in this slide.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So, how come?
Actually, there is some Valgrind mentions. I found some on today. Yeah. There may be certainly better places. I know that the cert site is actively supported. I can repeat the question. why? It's a statement that I talked about the cert site, and the cert site doesn't provide some information that other sites do.
Yeah.
and particularly with memory analysis. I think the cert site is very actively maintained, or appears to be now, and you could sign up and you can add to it if you want. They've just moved it to Confluence. I've signed up. I haven't added anything to it yet, but you do have that capability. Yeah, it seems to be getting that way. Any other questions? Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I don't understand. Stack Canary? Yeah, Canary. We haven't overtly used it. We're just now turning on the flags and for the compilers to create that for us. And some of those flags that I showed in the mitigation, we'll turn those on. We don't do anything overtly in the code for it. Black Hat.
Okay.
Yeah. What are some good resources or tools for people that are interested in becoming ethical hackers? And Black Hat. We have people that go there and speak and win competitions, and there's supposed to be a lot of fun. I haven't got there because I'm enslaved writing code. Yes, it is. Any other questions?
You mentioned fuzzy.
Yes. We, in our automated stuff, we actually have our automated continuous integration is a Ruby RSpec framework that works with our Artifactory and our repository and pulls out all the different pieces and tests it. And there are some fuzzing engines with Ruby that we use to inject into our C++ code. We haven't spun up. I spun up libfuzz when I was at C++ Now in May, and that looked really cool. I was able to replicate finding the Heartbleed bug in minutes. That's on our path. Since our other fuzzer works really well, we haven't introduced it yet. Any other questions? We have 10 minutes. Well, I don't have anything else to add, so thank you for coming. I hope this was useful.